G'day, guys. Welcome to Cryptid Command Episode 2. My name is Cameron.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Chris.
Hang up, job, Cameron.
I forgot my name.
Well, you know, peeling behind the curtain, we don't really know what we're talking about at all, including, at sometimes, what we're even called, how we're even called, and why. But that's okay. For the purpose of the listeners, we do have something, we do have some experience with, we do know what to talk about, and possibly might even have something that's of value to you guys. And that is, in this case, the scenarios, and specifically the Pendulum Pack.
Pendulum is the new tournament pack, the organized play pack that Privateer Press released a couple of weeks ago. And it's interesting. It's a damn interesting document. They've done something which I haven't really seen. I don't know if any other game does a escalation tournament.
Usually it's as a, like, I wouldn't say as a joke tournament, but it's usually a fluff or narrative kind of league is typically the reasons why you'd have this kind of tournament. Because most other tournament packages, especially for competitive games, you typically have all the games at the same tournament level for the sake of balancing. It's kind of similar to, like, you know, a whole bunch of it, basically, so everyone's always on a level playing field. But in this particular case, they've decided to throw some things into the wind, which is definitely interesting considering that, by nature, Warcaster is a game almost entirely dependent on scenario.
Now, just in the basic of it, though, the escalation nature, occurred to me is, like, often, like, a game will say that you can play it at any points level, but there's sort of there's like a gravity around certain points levels, right? So, like, if you're the sort of player who's like, I want to play War Machine, but I only want to play 50 points, right? You have less other players to face because most people are going to be playing the tournament standard. The fact is now that you've got three tournament standards, there's no, like, real there's now three different point scales that you can play the game at, even if you're playing casually against people who would not be playing as casually, which is cool.
They're all valid by the fact that if you can play at any timeline you want to play to, so a small game that takes less time, or you can play a longer game that'll take more time, but all of those games will be relevant to both casual and competitive play, which is nice.
Yeah, and they'd actually feel balanced as well. Like, honestly, War Machine realistically has, like, two, like, sizes. That's, one of them is not even an official one. It's Brawl Machine. And that basically is effectively
incredible.
The best.
Unity.
It's really
incredible
good.
How Brawl Machine's come out of goddamn nowhere.
Oh,
I've never played it.
It isn't really out of nowhere. It's more like finally someone putting together all of the, like, low-level stuff and getting, like, an actual
low-tier stuff.
Well, take Company of Iron, which was their last attempt at this kind of thing, and basically, you guys had a Company of Iron game. I remember your primary complaint was that Company of Iron takes about the same amount of time or more as a regular game of War Machine for not that much more payoff. It's not like a cut-down version at all. Mm. Whereas Brawl Machine, like, you
which
could
I don't
actually...
Know if they were, I don't know if they were actually going for with Company of Iron, but I do feel like they were building something which kind of lacked an audience.
Mm. Yes. In this particular...
The interesting part about this is you can also just do a slow grow sort of setting as well. You can start with a skirmish and build up your forces while painting them. It's also an interesting way you could do it.
They've just married their league and their tournament pack.
Yeah.
Into, which is a cool idea. I'm really glad that they came up with this because it has so many interesting benefits. I'm just surprised that I've never thought of doing it this way.
It's by nature of how Warcaster as a game works that this is all possible. After all, one of the issues with, like, less or, like, lower, like, lower points levels, especially in, say, War Machine, but also even games like 40k, is that, one, you kind of have more susceptibility to blowouts. Like, if you have a bad turn against, like, or rather, let's put it the wrong way. If you're up against a gun line and the gun line has a very good turn and you're in a small game, you basically lose everything. So you've got much more volatility that way. On the other hand, to put in reverse, if the gun line has a bad turn, they just get owned.
I remember once I saw. Okay, we're going to continue our. I'm going to continue our tradition of ragging on other games. I watched a game of Age of Sigmar, and it was a Skaven Gunline versus an Ogre Kingdom, just melee, like fast melee line. And it literally came down to, like, you know how, you know in that game you can have a double turn because it's like,
it's an Igo Yugo set, yes.
Yeah, so it was Ogres moved into range, Skaven then shot them, and then the next turn Skaven shot them again. And I was just sitting there for about an hour and a half, staring my head in my hands, like, why? They seem to be having fun, but if I was just picturing what I'd be like in that situation. It's like, well, that's sure a thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Warcaster does have blowouts, but it's less susceptible to them.
Yeah,
because of the nature of the way the game works, because you can always bring in more troops. The nastiest blowout I had versus you, like, it does get to a point where like I should probably have conceded, but we were showing a new player and it was a bit of a weird day. But it's just like I was bringing in troops and then those troops were dying. That was it for the last few turns. And yeah, so it's not impossible to have a blowout in Warcaster. You can solidly win, which is good, to be honest, because you kind of want you don't want a game to also reach that center point of balance where
everything's impossible. A stalemate. Yeah.
Yeah, where it's impossible to feel like you're advantaged.
Yeah. Well, in this particular case, I think the reason this sort of works is, one, the fact that, like, the objective of the game is not to kill everyone. It's usually a scenario. And then, two, I think the scenarios, by and large, I quite like. I have some issues with certain ones, and we're going to probably get into a few of them. But, and the flip side, like, the skirmish-sized scenarios don't feel like a downgrade, like, say, a lot of the scenarios I've seen for attempts to bring War Machine, for instance, to a smaller point scale, just feel like you can't take the steamroll scenarios. They're designed specifically for 75 points, but a lot of these smaller scenarios are basically just like, stand in the box. Mm. All right, now kill each other. That's your only...
The entire game is watching the players get into the ring like it's a boxing match.
Yeah.
And they just stand toe-to-toe and start wailing on each other.
Yep.
Yeah, the scenarios are an interesting... They're a good start. We'll talk about it later, about where I think we should... Where we think that they should go. But I think I'm always impressed. Maybe I give too much slack, but I'm always impressed when a new product comes out and the developer has obviously seen how things are going to an extent to fit together. And they haven't reached the point where they've unleashed, once they've unleashed on the market, like they haven't reached the steamroller point where it's had so many iterations now that you can fine tune it with like a tiny scalpel, right?
Yeah. Steamroller was originally a community project. Haxor was the original author of Steamroller. It was a completely separate PP endeavor. And it got properly adopted. Hell, Haxor, I believe, is still on the design team, if I'm remembering right. And yeah, like, the end product is, in fact, like, something that's been evolving over three editions of the game, right? You can kind of tell. Like, this, on the other hand, though, I think a lot of the stuff in, like, Pendulum... First, let's just get the other side of the way. Pendulum as a, like, pack being released is kind of not actually that big a deal to me, specifically because it's basically a reprint of a bunch of the stuff in the rulebook with tournament structure around it. I do agree the tournament structure is very interesting, and it's certainly a nice new way of doing it, but if you're expecting some like fancy new scenarios and funky new ways of contesting and scoring and stuff like that, none of it is there so far. Quite deliberately, as it turns out. I believe you had a chat with Faye at one point, Arian, and the whole point was to release the original Pendulum pack as close to the rulebook and the scenarios in the initial release as possible, so they could get as much data, because, well, you know, a lot of people are just currently stuck inside.
So this feels like it's a lot, like, just considering it as a beta. As like Chris said, most people aren't out playing games. People aren't going to be out playing games. People will be playing online. That'll take more time. People will get a chance to test it out and play it, but right now, if they give this like a year where people get to toy around, get a feel for it, it gives them a chance to really adopt and change it for the next one around. So this one does feel like, let's keep it close as we possibly can and adapt it after what we see, because right now there's not as much value for having like a super tight tournament pack at the moment. It's better to just maybe use the time to work on it more and let the community get a feel for it. Because the community is young, but also it's not like there's not a high demand for tournament games at the moment.
Oh, there's demand, but it shouldn't be.
Well, I mean, you know what I mean.
Yeah. Also, there's a couple of other little things. I think they don't want to they probably don't want to invalidate their mats so early.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. Those mats, by the way, are beautiful. Like,
they're very nice, and I hope I want the scenarios to change, and I want them to re-release, but I don't want to pay more money. So, Private Press, please make the mats a subscription.
I mean,
whenever you update the scenario, you send me more.
That's a yearly.
You can.
I mean, it's like a yearly subscription. It's not the end of the world. The problem is, then you're gonna have like few mats build up after a bit of like having been in it.
Oh well, you just.
But I mean, I guess it's not the end of the world because then you can use them for tournaments, and you just have to make do with the ones that are out of date.
Yeah,
you can pump the mats off to other games as well.
Yeah, you can play like 40K or Infinity on any of these maps so far because they're pretty just generic sci-fi with some glowy energy bits so far.
Yep.
Serenely passing down my mats to the lower games, like a benevolent deity.
Oh, trickle down mat economics.
And they said it would never happen. Yeah, so they didn't. They probably don't want the mat. Like, that's entirely supposition on my point, but on my part. But yeah, they probably don't want their mats to go out of date so quickly. It was a little bit of a shame when we got those Malifaux mats, and there
were
a couple.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Right away.
It wasn't right away, but it was like less than a year, and then suddenly the mat was not accurate, and that was that's a game with like a lot of like shit going on. So tracking where models and tokens were supposed to be for scenarios were a pain in the ass, to say the least.
Encrypted Command, the podcast where we shit on other games.
No, Malifaux's great. It's just that mat situation was just like, War Machine, you're like, scenario, flag, objective, done. And Malifaux, you're just like, okay, this needs to be precisely placed here. And then it can move around the battlefield as people fuck with it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, that's a game with literal scheme tokens.
Oh, yeah.
I do love it. Saying scheme tokens, good fun.
I know this is an audio podcast, and people who don't know Chris won't really get it, but like, if you've seen a game of Malifaux with all the tokens on the table, it pretty much looks like a general game of War Machine for Chris.
All right, for everyone who wants a mental image, just imagine, like, just take your token box. Just grab a handful of tokens and just like bounce the box.
Across the hat.
No, specifically, you have to bounce the box and watch where all the tokens explode out of.
My favorite part is watching Chris move a token from one miscellaneous part of the table to another as if it mattered, but nobody knows what he's doing. It's like watching a witch foretell your future. Like, just moving the token from one part to the other.
So far, there's a lot less of that in War Caster, and we're just using the literal cards to reflect.
Well, that's what
spells
they're also.
Often.
Yes, which is it's actually a really easy way of doing it.
Yeah,
they take up a lot of space on the table.
Yeah, but you can stand on it. Who cares? Yeah. It's flat.
Until you have to take
3D terrain, Arian.
I'm in the process of printing 3D terrain. I'm making the terrain more 3D. I'm adding dimensions.
More scattered terrain.
More do you want? Once some collision course comes in, I'm pretty sure we're gonna have all the scatter terrain we need, to be honest.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. And more questionable Super Soakers as well. terrain built from Super Soakers. For anyone who doesn't, who obviously wouldn't have seen the terrain setup, it turns out, if you have old toys and shit like that, they are great things to just basically cut down and use as sci-fi terrain. Just spray it black or spray it metal, paint it up a bit.
Yeah. And it looks like
a drilling rig. It really does.
I think it's if you go on YouTube, you can find for a lot of terrain makers. I think it's called the Super Soaker Challenge or something like that. A bunch of them took part of it, and they did like full tables with like $20 of Super Soakers. It's pretty rad.
It's beautiful. Anyway,
it's a cheap way to get a table done.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I got the table that we generally play on for a good $20-$30, which is not bad, at all.
But as people say, Arian, it needs more terrain.
Yeah, it does.
Well, that's actually a thing we should get into. So, scenarios-wise, first things first. Yes, Warcaster is actually one of those games where you probably can just, like, the terrain you can scale up or down quite a lot. It definitely doesn't feel like a game that should be played in a car park, but you don't need Infinity's size terrain, because a lot of the terrain rules aren't as finicky. Like, Infinity, terrain matters a huge amount, because you really need to cut line of sight down as much as possible. Like, you can't make, like, just basically... If you're making a thoroughfare, it should be, like, a broad, like, street kind of thoroughfare, and be very obvious, as in, this is the danger zone kind of thing, right? Because of just how dominant, like, AROs are in that game. I walk out a corner and a sniper from the tower on the other side behind the Coke billboard blows your character's face off.
Ranges are also generally a lot longer. I mean, they become less effective the farther out you are in most cases, but gotten most like a third of the way across the table with like a single model sometimes. So yeah, Warcaster is not quite as short as War Machine, but it's definitely somewhere in between.
Correct.
Yeah. Warcaster's movement's a lot more than War Machine.
Also generally true. It's just more flexible because of the wet nature of it.
Yeah, so, and you don't lose shooting when you're getting in melee, which is pretty rad.
Yep. All right, so yeah. I think we should probably dive a bit more into how to actually do scenario, like the pendulum impact itself, and more importantly, how to win.
So we've been playing mostly full battle force, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, quite a lot.
Yeah, we kind of jumped in, and I think it was probably some supposition, but like we kind of went to the War Machine standard of the rule book says you can play skirmish, it says you can play that, but like full battle force is where the game's going to be. And we've kind of been playing that for a year since the rule book was released.
As the degenerate competitive players we are.
Yes. And so we've been playing full battle force for pretty much the whole time. And we have played some skirmish games, but full battle force is a different game.
Yeah.
It is very different game. It is weird how different the two sizes can be when, if you think about it, really all you're adding is two turns and different scenarios per round.
It also changes the amount of models you can have on the table.
Yes. Yeah. To an extent, yeah.
Which changes the game a lot.
Yeah. Every time I go back to play a skirmish game or watch a skirmish game, I am often astounded by how quickly things get knocked off the table because of how close everything is. Playing the full battle force is a very different game. It's a slower game. It has a different pace to it than skirmish does, which is really nice. And it's taken a long time for us to get used to because it is a very unique kind of a very unique setup.
I mean, I can tell you from my personal experience with skirmish versus full battle force, a lot of support models in general in skirmish, you basically wouldn't take unless you're in full battle force. For instance, combat engineers for Marcher Worlds and paladin commanders, I would say, for ISA, they remove activation tokens abilities from, like, you know, squads and warjacks, respectively. They're not very, very useful in skirmish. Like, they're typically a reactionary thing you do because your opponent has put an activation token on your warjack or your squad, and you need that squad to do something, or you need that warjack to go murder a bunch of shit.
Yeah, I think the engineer's still got its place because warjacks in skirmish are really strong.
They are, but
far stronger than they are in full battle.
They are, but I've never actually found an engineer has had the time to remove a token. It's just not necessary, frankly. With only three turns in a pulse round, you're like, you have to do it, like, you're basically doing it like on turn one or two to even get any effect.
Yeah, I find the exact opposite. I find activation token removal is way more useful at a small point game because models tend to come on and die quite quickly. So being able to take the things that are on the table that have activated that people have written off for the turn and being able to activate them is really useful. So abilities like the engineer or cards with activation, I feel, have a lot more value at that point level.
Where I agree with you. It's like the model perspective, yeah, I don't think the engineer is actually that good, for instance. But cards, no, 100% agree.
I still think the engineer is great because he can tune up a heavy and then let it reactivate for, like, at the end after it's already killed a bunch of shit. And when you can do that to a strike raptor, like, it's insane how much work it does on a table that size.
Ryan, are you trying to tell me that the strike raptor does a lot of work? Because I don't know about that.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't know because you play ISA, you have broken warjacks.
the strike raptor does the opposite role of the Mama Morningstar, who just keeps bringing more lives into the world. The Strike Raptor's role is to take the lives out of the world. There are now too many, you see.
The Morningstar throwing more paladins at the Strike Raptor. Protect me, you fools!
But talking about
death and Mama is life.
Yes.
Mama Morningstar.
Like talking about support models, I wouldn't take the Grafter for a skirmish because of said reasons, like Chris said.
Yeah.
But I would I would take a Paladin Commander or take any of like that in that because of the reactivations are so handy, especially if someone puts a Null Collider on Cryolock. You that tells Cryolock on you to stop you from activating that thing and you really wanted to because it was a part of your plan.
I guess also
skirmish is harder to keep people alive. Right, yeah, like the support models who die easily, like it's just not freaking worth it. Especially the heroes, right? So like Myra, who's in the collision course rules, she is extremely squishy, right? And even though she might be one of the most powerful models in the faction, if not the game, I can't take her in skirmish. She'll just take a shot to the face like instantly because the game's so close together.
Skirmish is a lot more concentrated, so. As, like, something we'll pull over again for more machine work models are a lot more valuable. So things that can actually contribute to the fight tend to have more value to summon and keep on the table. Unless they can bring a lot of stuff with them, like in the case of the engineer, in my opinion, who can reactivate a heavy, tune something up, and strip stealth from something all in the same, like, activation.
Yeah, your support models, like, because, like, weavers are support models-ish.
I mean, depending on the weaver and depending on your hand, because
when you bring a support model in skirmish, it's got to have a purpose. In full battle force, it's a little more permissible for you to bring just a dude. Like as long as you're thinking clearly about where they're going, that's fine. But throwing a grafter in your list on the off chance that you got the right cards in the right board position to take advantage of it, that's great. That's perfectly perfectly valid.
In my opinion, I don't really like hunters in skirmish because it's one single shot and it can be really valuable, but I always feel like I'd rather activate one of the many other things on the table.
Yeah, that dude loves to die.
Yeah, that too.
I don't know. Like, hunters are also, because I find in skirmish, solos are much more of a premium because you have much less slots available to bring in random solos. And hunters are very good at killing solos. I know where you're coming from, and honestly, like, I think that's probably where we have a difference of opinion is basically hunters versus engineers. And Lord knows, I hate it when you just pop a hunter out and then he randomly dies by accident to blast damage, right? 10 out of 10 game experience right there.
Huge fan of my Paladin Commander's, like, the smallest gun in the universe. Yeah, which happens to be a blast weapon.
He has a freaking iPod on his shoulder and it just apparently summons explosions. And because the guy has negative armor, right? Like, basically, the hunter has magnets that attract shrapnel as opposed to get rid of the shrapnel.
So all of his bones are hollow.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, he has to so he can run faster. And that's where the speed 7 comes at a cost, buddy. I actually think this is probably something worth getting into. So, by and large, in Warcaster, one of the principles I'd say is try and optimize your activations as much as possible. So that means that every turn, make sure you actually are capable of activating a solo in a thing, and preferably the thing should not be a second solo unless you're playing AC, at which point, like, a Marauder is pretty good, right? So activating two Marauders, it's not actually that big a deal.
Non-skirmish.
Any solo is better than no solo.
Correct. So you want to optimize your turns. Now, the reason I bring this up specifically to skirmish is that in terms of, like, ideally with most rosters, what I've at least found to work, and people may want to tune this however much they would like, half of your list should be solos, plus the hero. So in skirmish, you have 8 choices plus 1 hero, which sounds like a decent amount, but in actual practice, it's really not, because you need to take warjacks and you need to take squads. I mean, you could decide not to, but some scenarios are locked into taking squads. And more importantly, you've still got 3 cards in your deck. Let's just say you took no warjacks or no squads. You'd have 3 cards in your deck that are now literally dead because they're warjack buffs or squad buffs and you've got no targets. So then you're like left with basically, okay, you could take 2 jacks, 2 squads, and then 4 solos, but oh, hang on a minute, we've got access to vehicles now. Do we take vehicles as well? And also, maybe we want 3 squads.
Do you take hero vehicles? Do you take that risk?
Yeah, because after all, like, if a hero dies in skirmish, that's an actual permanent cap on how much you can bring in. And it
hurts. You're losing 10% of your list in a game where you're not supposed to be able to lose parts of your list so willy-nilly.
Yeah, and we just said how, like more lethal skirmishes, just because of how much closer things generally are. Action typically starts by the mid to end of the first pulse round, which is not a lot of time at all. And those points are really hotly contested. So with all this said, like, your solo choice is extremely important to consider. And hence we've got this talk, like, this is one of the reasons for support models in general. You're going to have to be very careful and, like, give it a little bit of practice on just basically whether they're worth including or not. Because you'll find in a lot of skirmish scenarios, they might not be worth it just because the activations just aren't as efficient. It's also entirely possible, like, the correct choice is bring in your hero as opposed to bring in some rando solo, and you'd be quite well rewarded for doing so.
Yeah, especially depending on the hero as well, because if you're looking for from the perspective of, like, I'm trying to make the most optimal turns, activations, and your hero is Voss, who is in his element, has some of the dumbest stat line, but if you're more than 8 inches away, he's kind of like a fat kid at a playground. You just need to keep a little bit further away from him, and he's like Uda from The Simpsons. Please don't make me run. I'm full of chocolate.
Yes.
So like, you're like, okay, I could bring in Voss. He's one of my tougher solos, and he does good work. But is that an efficient activation?
Yes.
It depends on the time. The Warcaster is very good as a game of depends. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to make a lot of definitive statements on things just because there are so many little things that can be considered.
It's actually good you brought up Voss, because that was going to be my perfect example. So you get one hero choice, and it's not like full battle force where you just pick all the heroes, or full battle force after collision course where you pick all the heroes minus Voss because you hate the shit out of Voss, Harry.
I want to love him so badly.
But, I mean, it's basically... But here's the thing, is like, if you were playing ISA and you're in a skirmish scenario, well, all of a sudden, the actual question is, which of your 3/4 heroes you have access to do you actually bring? Because... Like, I think the correct answer, for instance, would probably be Wojtek.
I agree.
Yeah. Like, it's definitely so not Myra for the reasons we got into. And Voss, I think, is good. Like, Voss might actually be worth, like, one of your 8 slots. Your 8 legitimate slots. But then, oh, God, that's like, if Voss dies randomly, and, you know, he loves randomly dying, or rather...
Oh, God, he your loves opponent's it so bad.
Well, it's actually more the opponents really love randomly teching to kill Voss with good reason, right?
Yeah.
Well, then, yeah, you're down like a tenth of your list.
That's why I liked to bring Morgrave in general, just because he's got nice defensive stance. Like, defensively, he's a firebrand, which is pretty sweet for a 1DC model. So I think we've gone slightly off topic. I'm going to try to snake us back around to full battle force. What is this game feeling like? Why, as opposed to skirmish, because we brought up a lot of stuff about skirmish, but at the full battle force size, it is a different game. And yes. One thing I want to really reiterate is how much bigger the board is.
Yeah.
How much further away the players are from each other, and how that impacts the game.
So with skirmish, I think the easiest way I describe it is that skirmish is a game with almost zero chill. Like, you're murdering from turn 2 onwards, right? Like, hell, like, there was even a thing with one of the reasons Gatecrasher got nerfed is because Gatecrasher allows you to start murdering from top of 2 onwards, which is top of, ludicrous.
Yeah.
It's actually crazy.
Early on, they discovered, and this is still, it's not true anymore, but it's close to true still, that Nyx could drop gates in the opponent's deployment zone in skirmish. Back before the Fulcrum got nerfed, but it's still a lot. It is nuts.
We also, like, even if you can deal with it and can counter it, it's just not really a great gaming experience. But either way, though, because Full Battle Force, as you said, is a bigger board and the scenario elements are more widely spaced, what ends up happening is a lot of stuff gets stuck on the, like, sticks to the table. And sometimes not even just because, it's not like the models have magically gotten any tougher. What actually happens frequently is the models get less relevant to the game, and thus they're lower on the target priority list. So oftentimes you'll summon a squad of like Fireteam or Paladin Annihilators or something, and they'll camp one of the flags that you think is going to be near the action, and they'll never get touched all game. You won't even you might not even ever activate them, because they'll happily cap a flag because the action, for whatever reason, due to the scenario, will move elsewhere. Yeah. And oftentimes that is a thing with the game. Like, Skirmish, it's just all hands on deck. We've got to be murdering at all times, right? But Full Battle Force, the murdering happens at sequential parts of the zone, and it is often worth summoning models with the express intent of not activating them or activating them as little as possible. This is why support is allowed to go in. It's, for instance, like the combat engineer, as I said, like, you now are able to use this guy's remove a focus token, a move an activation token, sorry, for four turns to get an optimal effect, maybe five turns even, right? And yeah, that's pretty damn good.
Yeah, one of the sort of mantras I've been doing, I think it depends on the faction, because the faster your faction is, the more you can ignore this rule. The slower the faction is, the more you have to really consider it. But you have to keep your eyes on the goddamn prize. The only thing that matters is points. That's the only way you win. Which means that literally every activation you do, every cipher card, every gate should be aimed at how does this get me more points. And one of the most important things that we started realizing after a while of playing Full Battle Force, one of the best ways to do it, like the most efficient squad scoring play, is where the squad never activates. You bring it in with the gate and you use some on table effect to make sure that the squad gets onto the flag and you never have to activate it. It's not because the squad activation would necessarily be bad, but it's so much more efficient if, like, that's of your turn, that cipher card got you a point or two rather than a activation.
No, that's definitely true. The less amount of effort you have to actually needing to score something, the better it is overall. So if I can just summon something on as part of a normal turn end and then play a card that immediately lets something move at the beginning of my next turn, to score that, people won't immediately go and try and kill something that was just summoned as, depending on where it is on the board. But if you have that, but because they don't know what cards you have in your hand, being able to just like slightly nudge them over into scoring and behind cover can be a huge changer. But they might not necessarily be a target because of location and because there's obviously something more threatening somewhere else on the board, like a Strike Raptor looking at your model scoring a zone.
Yeah, and if you're like okay, my path to victory in this game is that there's three scenario zones on my side of the board and there's one near my opponent's. If I'm planning on just winning by one point, right, all you need to do is you need to score that one on your opponent's once or deny your opponent scoring on the corners. So the best way to do that would be to maximize the amount of activations you have lunging at that opponent point. Which means that you don't want to be spending activations on your guys in your backyard. You want those to be solved as quickly as possible without you having to spend activations. The less activation you have to do on that, the more activations you have up front, blowing stuff up off your opponent at some points.
Yep.
Yeah.
You'd want to plan out a lot of your turns with ciphers and the like, specifically to try and weave in those cipher cards you need. I'm going to assume we've basically talked about Our Lord and Savior, the greatest card, one of the greatest cards in the game, Displacement Index.
Displacement Index is so damn strong.
Why is Displacement Index one of the best cards? I think, actually, especially in factions that don't need Arcane Synthesis, it is stronger than Arcane Synthesis. But I think even in like a faction like, say, Marchers or AC, there is an argument that I think you could make that the card is actually stronger than Arcane Synth.
It's more useful, I find. Arcane Synthesis is a bit awkward sometimes.
Correct. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm trying basically, like, you know, this giant ruby is almost as good as this equally giant emerald, right? But
yes,
that's kind of how one of the reasons they're strong is, like, that, like, Displacement Index is strong is because effectively it allows you to trade one card for, like, one plus scenario points, right?
Yeah. And not just that, also, there are other cards that allow tricky pieces of movement, which is stuff that I've been considering a couple of times. Things like a Mortality Destabilizer, the card which allows you to bring a troop back, There's no restriction on that one. So if you've summoned a squad and they're not allowed to, and they're not on the flag, if one of them dies, you can mortality destabilize back on, now they're on the flag, right? Less good than displacement index, because the it requires your opponent's like help, unless you can do a tricky spray, but that's getting into a little bit of weird territory. No. There's ISA.
Much more useful is that you can recontest something, like say you've got a squad of defenders and they're dicking around your opponent's side of the table. You can just, instead of having to activate them to be close, you can just mortality destabilize them, put more guys next to the opponent's flag, right? Yeah. And same even better with AC. Yeah, even better with like AC, where they just have a grafter show up next to a good doggy, and the doggy is just like, I'm still alive because I'm impossible to kill. And the grafter's like, all right, I'll bring you some, like, you know, boys to play with.
Yes, the grafter's ability to bring something back, like when that can translate directly into victory points, that's why part of the reason when the grafter's resurrection and thing, like, he's not bringing back good troops. You're not going like, I could activate a marauder or a weaver, but I'm going to activate the grafter to bring back these two guys because I'm really looking forward to those two reavers going and fighting those guys. That's not what you're bringing them back for. You want them to sit on the zone.
Yes.
And that's where Resurrection Protocol can start to actually matter, because now not only are they irritating squads to kill because they're not actually doing that much to you, so spending
Resurrection
time killing them.
Resurrection Protocol being the ISA spell?
No, Resurrection Protocol, that's the ability on the grafter to bring back two guys.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it is. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I don't remember the name of the one in my faction. That one's, it's probably fine as well. I put it below Mortality Destabilizer because not only does it require the opponent to kill stuff, but it's also telegraphed.
Yeah, but I could see, yeah. I don't know, I could see that one being put on, like, a squad of defenders now. I've seen defenders in action. The most, like, why do I have to deal with these guys? Can I just not?
defenders who win the award of, do I have to activate these guys? Do I have to spend any effort on these? It's the least effort unit you want.
But this is, like, actually a perfect example of, like, how ridiculous Warcaster can be sometimes. Like, defenders, I think, might be one of the best squads in the game, because you never want to actually interact with them. So the ISA player just bullies you with this squad of, like, you know, you need people to stand on flags? Let it be these guys with shields and force pikes, right? Just let it be these guys. And, yeah, sometimes they do activate, and they actually, like, kick a fair bit of ass, right?
Did I tell you about the game where, a uncharged guy walked up to a nemesis, the nemesis who flies and thus has two red dice, and did two wounds to it in a hit.
Yep. That was
what a
fun
hero.
Game.
The next turn, he was the remaining member of that squad. I was just like, ah, what the fuck? Why not? And then the next act, like, the nemesis didn't do anything about it, and Cameron was essentially like, ah, that could never happen again. So the next pulse round, he walked backwards and killed a marauder. What a goddamn hero.
Yes.
Truly, he was Doom Guy, the Paladin defender who was too angry to die.
Yeah, but if you were, of course, a Ranger, you would then cleave from the first Marauder into the second Marauder, so, you know.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, no other faction is allowed to have good models.
I mean, look, you said it was a Timmy faction, and Timmy wants the best things in life, so. But yes, like, this thing, like, I do not, this is kind of the difference to me about, like, full battle force for skirmish. I don't think defenders would be good in skirmish, generally speaking, because you kind of need your squads, or you need your squads to be doing stuff, like murdering,
for
instance.
You want to be doing as much work as possible. You can't roll the front punches, and you can't do that as much with defenders. They're just not as good at it.
Yeah. Whereas, like, in full battle force, because the game's slower and more chill, you actually, these squads like defenders are absolutely perfect, because they allow you to just take a zone and just go, like, too much effort. It's not that they're locked down, the zone is impenetrable, it's that it's too much effort to deal with right now. I'd say another big difference between the two is the relative value of Furies, the nukes, that is. After all, Furies do not really scale up, but Furies in skirmish to me are, like, I think a lot more impactful, just because, frankly, if you blast something off the table with a Fury, the proportional amount of your list that you destroy is a lot, like, higher. But that's not to say Furies are bad in a full battle force. It's more, I find, what the purpose of a Fury is to either problem solve, like, let's just say you go into maul those defenders we're just talking about, right? One of them alive, like Arian, like, you know, Cameron did against Arian. The purpose of a Fury is to kill that last guy. Or, on the reverse thing, you got that Nemesis. The purpose of that Fury is to get that Nemesis off the point so you can score.
Yeah. Yeah. The Furies are also a little more impactful in Skirmish because more stuff's dead, which means you are more often have Arc in your well, meaning that they actually hit harder.
Yeah. After all, the whole point of Furies to me is to act as a, like, rebound mechanism. After all, there's no easier way to cast a seven Fury strike than when your opponent has killed, like, everything.
Yeah. Obviously, playing the game like the biggest brain zench, where you're just like, glad that you've killed all of my models.
I'm glad you killed my Strike Raptor, because now I can cast a 7-3 blast to just one-shot your Morningstar in return.
It is hilarious. It's a good feeling when you just get all the red dice in your hands, and you're just like, oh, you freaking asked for it.
That you just use, like, what was it, a velocity projector and throw that guy off a building as well. Just because you can.
Four off the table, which instantly kills them. That's a thing to remember, everybody. That's a thing to remember, especially when you're talking about 80 mil bases who like being within range of the table edge.
I think that was, you almost attempted that in one of our games, didn't you?
And then I it was so mean that I decided not to.
Yeah, first time playing Empyreans, watch your vehicle just get slammed off the table. Yeah, that would have been
especially
fun.
Especially in skirmish size as well, I believe. Incidentally, before we move on, we'll talk about this later. Anything else regarding Full Battle Force? I was going to go back to the Pendulum pack and how you can swap things in and out, but I just want to say, anything else regarding Full Battle Force itself we should bring up?
You describe it as more chill, which I don't want. I mean, to an extent, I agree, but I find that Full Battle Force has a lot of chances for mistakes, and you have to get used to, like, every game likes to say it's like chess, but the thing about Warcaster, especially in Full Battle Force, is that you really are looking a few turns ahead because you're dropping these troops down and you might never get the chance to activate them very well. You need to make sure that you have exactly the right troops in the right position because if you put a jack down, this is something I often did. You put a jack down and you get a mediocre activation out of it. And then you're like, oh, well, unless I get the card to reactivate it, it's another, like, 20 activations before it's the next turn. So you've got to be really careful with where you start placing things because you will be staring at them. Like, turn one, I've put a squad on a flag, and then I've just been – and for the rest of the game, I've realized, like, if that guy was, like, half an inch across, he'd have cover. And he's stuck there, and I never want to activate them again. But I have made my turn worse by not thinking ahead. So, Warcaster, it's definitely advantaged for you to, like, start to muscle memory that shit as much as possible. Because proper placement is something which will often last.
It's also worse than...
Go ahead, Cameron.
Sorry, there's also a point of, like, making sure you actually have a solo and a unit to activate, because the last game I played against Arian, I kept summoning solos because I needed to summon solos because he was destroying them. And then every single turn, I'd only summon a unit, and then he'd kill the two solos I summoned. And I would go, oh, that's unlikely, but it happened. Mm. So I've only got a mediocre activation because I've only got a mediocre activation.
Yeah,
I didn't
have
a card to change that.
If you can play, like, this comes back into again, but, like, if you can put a gate in the, you might want to think really carefully about where's the perfect place to place this gate, where I can put the stuff near to the zones where I want, the stuff in the cover that I want, and then maybe one or two models that are completely out of line of sight. The perfect gate placement can allow that to happen, right? And having stuff that is completely outside of line of sight just to make sure that you've got some level of efficient turn coming up, like, that's a necessary thing to do. So you've got your gate, you put it somewhere you've got to plan out in your head where you're putting everything around it. Because, like, for instance, something which I know I keep doing and and it's an annoying habit, I'll put a gate somewhere which is fully outside of line of sight. And I'll be like, okay, I know that this gate is most likely safe. But I've put it so close to the building now, or the thing that is behind line of sight, that when I summon the stuff in, they actually have to be pulled back. There's no space for them next to the building anymore, which gives a line for my opponent to attack them. So yes, like, it's really getting gate placement to be exactly where you want it to be. It's a hard skill, and like we've been playing for a year now, and it's still like a difficult skill. And every single time, every game, I'm putting down a gate and then swearing because of I'm just like it should be a little bit across, often, or it should be a little bit here or there.
Often I find it's actually a way up mechanic of do you risk where the gate is when it's a gate, because if it's out of cover, oftentimes focus can get bled off of it real quickly, or a bunch of idiot rangers show up with like their grenades and just throw it and collapse the gate. So that's where you want to deploy it in cover, but because the gate physically occupies space, you're trading off the potential to put things in cover later for the potential to have your gate stay in cover now. That's usually what I find happens. Like, similarly, if you're deploying the gate out of line of sight, like, one of the hiding spots then is then currently occupied by said gate. This can, however, work other ways, like the fact that sometimes you just put gates out of, like, look for really good vantage points. Like, putting gates on high ground is almost always a good idea, especially if your models that you're summoning have flight or there's good access to ladders, because when you're shooting from low ground to high ground, you always have cover if you're on the high ground. So then you can plate your gate, like if you take a roof, you can place the gate right in the middle of the roof and it's still got cover, and so will everything that comes out of that gate. Also, the gate can be much more easily placed because, you know, it will have cover basically from anything shooting at from the low ground.
Unless you put it on a roof and you've realized later that there's no room for the warjack you wanted to deploy.
Yes, which has happened to me many times.
me and Cameron have this recurring thing where Cameron will put a gate on. There's this little tiny building that I made a while ago, which is pretty much exactly big enough for like a gate, and it can summon like a squad and a solo, or like one warjack. And he'll put his thing up there, and then I'll put a gate exactly next to it, and we both get to stare at each other and never have fun again.
Until one of us destroys it.
Yeah, until one of us is like, oh, fine, and collapses it or something.
I was also going to mention that if you're using 3D terrain, and I always do this every single time someone puts a gate down, I forget where it is. And it's always in the middle of the board behind something.
Yeah, and true light of sight is an important thing in this game.
Yes, it is very important in this game, and I keep forgetting.
It's as important in this game as it is in every game, yes.
Well, yes.
But War Machine is not a thing. Because there's so much flat terrain everywhere, right? But like going from War Machine to Warcaster, you forget sometimes that models can be placed outside of your line of sight because you have fallible, disgusting human eyes.
Yes, and it's very annoying because usually you see a flat forest and then something behind that flat forest, and you can see that. But when it's behind an actual building, which is 3D terrain, it's kind of like, there is something there. Whoops.
That was one thing I didn't appreciate. I didn't think I'd have to like appreciate is like pre-measuring with base sizes what fits on what buildings.
Pre-measuring what you want to put out of a gate is very important. And like this is us like playing for months on pretty similar boards because we're using similar pieces of terrain. Go to a tournament and you'll just be like subtly trying to put like just leave, you know, standing near a table, yawning, dropping a 50mm base on the place where you're hoping that it would be, just so nobody notices what your plans are.
Just basically go to like the infinity board because that probably got co-opted for the tournament, and then just like measuring just how much, like how many things fit around the giant Coke sign that you want to throw a gate on top of.
All right. Do you think we should move on to talking to each of the scenarios specifically?
I want to just do a little bit on pendulums, like one of the other features of pendulum, which I think is going to be much more important. And that's the special issue swaps, I believe it's called. It's the fact that you can semi-customize your list. Also, I think we should probably talk a little bit about modified skirmish, but we can get into that a little later. But basically, this is rather important. So there's a concept in War Machine called, like, specialists. And it was an interesting concept, but to me it always just felt like effectively a shoehorned in thing, because every time I saw specialists, effectively, like, there was always some kind of reason you couldn't use specialists, right? Like, you had to build in, like, Vanguard deployments. So you had to use two casters from, what was the name of that thing called?
Special issue?
Yeah, whatever that... Yeah, anyway, there usually was best,
hey,
like...
listeners, send us in the comments. What are we forgetting?
Oh, man. Active duty roster. That's what it was.
God damn it, Chris.
Yes.
We're trying to build engagement here.
I'm sure. Well, they can still send it to us anyway, because I'll probably call something wrong, I'm sure. So for instance, you can use specialists in some tournaments, assuming, let's just take the current one, and because I'm me, let's just say Kador. So you have to play two or four, five casters who are, I wouldn't say top tier, but they're like decent-ish, but you know, they're just kind of a random mixture of stuff. And you have to play in two themes, which are definitely off meta. And if you do all of that stuff, congratulations, you get to have specialists, right? Good job, here's your prize. And then the specialists themselves are like, sometimes instead of taking one brick in a sock warjack, I take a different brick in a sock warjack. Yeah, fucking value.
So special issue, you get to allocate one solo, one warjack, one squad, and one vehicle. And when you're talking about cards, you get one harmonic, one overdrive, one geometric, and one fury. I haven't thought about this too much. Trying to find generic builds rather than just tooling.
For me, this is where like the bomber chassis of a Strike Raptor lives. Like, because you have a chance of like one in four matchups to be like compound armor, you're just like, the Bomber Raptor doesn't feel like super great into that matchup. It's probably fine, but it's just a little worse. So you always feel like there's probably a slightly more efficient build I could be taking. But if I could just swap that Bomber build in and out on a Specialist roster, I might see that on the table more often. But without Specialists, I doubt I'd ever really take that build, because one in four matchups, depending if everything is equal, it's just like the worst choice.
Important to note that your solo can be your hero or a hero.
Yep.
Which is an important thing to note, because you might just...
Well, that works for your vehicle too, which is a big deal.
Well, yes, your vehicle slot can be the hero vehicle as well. I like the thought. I do always worry about special issue. While Chris was talking about like how it's annoying to have requirements for these things, whenever I look at this, I'm like, I should be putting stuff which I will be taking in my list in the special issue section and always sub it in, because my opponents might not notice. Right, because your opponents might not be looking at the special issues, and they might just be looking at your regular list, and so you always sub in just because they might not think to sub in their important stuff for the stuff you've got in your special issue. I don't know. Like, if you game this system correctly, there is a way to play it.
Is what you're telling me is you write the Strike Raptor in, which is the Bomber Cortex. So it's the Bomber, the double rocket pods, and the double flamethrowers. And you make that the main deck choice, and you have the actual Strike Raptor with, you know, the double battle rifle, double particle cannon, and the, like, dogfighter Cortex hidden safely in Specialist where no ISA player will spot it. The ISA player goes, oh, finally, a game without a real Strike Raptor. I'm in.
Yeah, like, theoretically, if once builds start to become more specialized over time, this will be an issue which will get worse.
Actually see the purpose of Specialists is specifically for rules that you think you might need, but not necessarily use. For the ability to strip Cypher cards or the ability to strip Arc, because in some matchups, like... The ability to strip Arc sometimes is utterly useless, or just basically a thing you just do to gates. And
or something helps your opponent, to be honest.
Yeah, sometimes it's like beneficial, and then other times it's like that might be the one and only way you're gonna have to kill, like, I don't know, a strike raptor with a fucking dogfighter cortex, because you can actually knock all the arc off of it so it can stop dodging your shit, and then you can deliver some righteous fury. Or especially with like collision course and some of the really strong furies, being able to slot in malediction Rubik or some witch hunt, extra witch hunters if you're playing AC, or a version of a Warjack which has one of those guns with, like, whatever that hex blasting thing is, that's when I think it's this becomes quite important. It also means...
The Witch Hunters are a good place here. The Witch Hunters, that feels like the perfect squad for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And I think the amount of models that will enter this part of the roster will start growing, especially as more heroes show up. Like, if nothing else, like, one of the solo choices could always be the random hero that's like a 5%er. Like, I don't know, he's the ISA hero, or in this case a 25%er. He's an ISA hero who does literally nothing except against Marcher Worlds, at which point he's like immune to, like, you know, particle cannons, and he automatically hits and kills rangers, you know, that guy.
Come on, PP, make this model, I need it.
Captain Ranger Killer.
Captain Stabs Marchers.
Captain Stabs Marchers. Doesn't afraid of anything. But yeah, like, this part, I find it interesting and a good bit of future-proofing that this is baked in literally from the start. And between this and the escalation format, I'm quite keen to see how, like, Pendulum shakes out. I suspect the first versions of Pendulum, like, they're going to be better than certainly, say, the first versions of Steamroller, because they're building on about 10 plus years of Steamroller and tweaked and adapted, plus the scenario packs of other games. But version 2 of Pendulum, I think, will be where this game lives and dies. And given what I've seen so far, I suspect it's going to be much more where it lives and shines.
Yeah. So now I think we should move on. We should just have a couple of notes on our experiences with each of the major full Battle Force scenarios. Just because they are some different beasts. PP have definitely inserted a lot of variation between each of these scenarios. So they're getting a lot of good data out of these as well. Because some of these scenarios I quite like. Some of them I think need work. But yeah, so I think we should start. Number one is absolute pressure. This is a really weird, like, they start off weird. With the 9-square grid, each 16 by 16. This scenario is very strange because the biggest thing about it is that you only contest and capture when you are fully within one of these squares, and it's models, not units, which means that mantlets and void gates contest and score, which is very strange.
I'm going to get this one out of the way because we haven't brought it up before, but one of the current issues with the game is going second is significantly stronger than going first. And that's because when you go second, you have the last possible potential to both score and contest X.
And the faster you are, that compounds. Marchers going second are extremely strong because the speed of all of their models to contest, as well as the innate advantage of going second.
So this is where the scenario, I think, is, like, most, like, exemplifies this problem, because if you go second on this one, you literally can basically have a, say, funnily enough, a squad of, like, rangers, like, walk and displace and then get, like, you know, do their slip displacer again, and then throw a gate out and, like, basically stop you contesting, like, 2 to 3 different, like, things. Especially, like, because in this particular case, in order to contest territory, it's just a model's base, and there's 4 models in a ranger squad, even if there's taken some casualties and you're standing in a perfect, you know, like, square around the 4. You can easily contest at least 2, and frequently they can be the opponent's back 2 territories.
Especially since, remember, you can actually summon out of a gate on the last turn going second. And so, like, a gate which is near one of the junction points can suddenly summon a squad which can now contest all 4.
Yep.
That is a nasty downside. On the upside, though, this is one of the few full battle scenarios where all models can contest and score, which means that, like, you are not married to squads, which is very nice. It is definitely a scenario where squads are still very powerful because they can contest more than anything else, because every other model type can only contest or capture one zone, while a squad can capture four. But you can use all the other stuff more, which is going to be a recurring thing which occurs in all of the full Battle Force ones, where squads are very, very strong, and it's hard to use anything but squads sometimes, especially if you're playing ISA, for instance, where it's not as much of a big deal.
Honestly, I wouldn't even say it's just an ISA thing. I think it's all four of the factions. Especially now that AC have gotten access to Rakers, because Rakers are so good. You could have exactly the same situation you just mentioned, where you have, a guy near a squad, you're going last, and then all of a sudden a grafter walks up to a Rake and goes, have some bros. And, go contest three scenario points. In the meantime, be stealth, right?
Yeah.
And digging out the Raker, even in the meantime, the Raker will be able to control the territory, right? By itself, and be as tanky as, honestly, a really good solo from another faction.
Also, 2 weeks of 4-4. God, Rakers are good.
Yeah. They are, what was it? Armor 4, Defense 4? They only have 2 wounds, is their quote-unquote weakness?
Yeah, that is their weakness, yes.
Yeah.
They are an exceptionally good model. One of the best ones.
Yeah. That all said, it is nice that, your fair and balanced Raptor, or of one variety or another, is basically, your OP oppressive Gatecrasher Morningstar is still able to be used as a scenario piece. I find that this scenario, a lot of times, it's about stopping the potential of what we just described, YOLO, reach for the corner of the side, things, and that's by basically trying to kill and control where the infantry are. Because, keep in mind, warrior models are all that can place gates, apart from random gatecrasher nonsense.
And even squads are the fastest ones. Squads are the fastest ways of placing gates 99% of the time.
Correct. So, what you're realistically going for, high on the murder list, oftentimes you can take a scenario detriment on, pulse round 1 or 2, in order to make sure that there are no things around that can contest, say, your, if not your entire side of the table, then, your pocket. Your back two corners, your back middle and back one of the corners kind of situation. While you yourself are able to threaten all of their zones instead.
The big thing about this scenario is really it's controlling the points where the squares meet. That's where almost all of the fighting is going to be happening. So there's technically a lot more freedom than the other scenarios, but there are four spots on this table where 99% of the combat's going to be about, and it's going to be trying to put squads and contesting models onto. So you want to contest other parts of the zone, but squads want to be in that those central quarters to do the maximum amount of point contesting and capturing.
Yeah, and even then, just basically, here's the thing, it's the doing the starfish spread of, contesting four things is not even what the danger is, although you can threaten that, certainly. Mostly, it's about throwing gates in other people's shit, because this is one of those scenarios where frequently you can throw a gate with five arc out there, summon four things out of it, four marauders sound, horrifying in this scenario, but you could do something like that, and then leave one arc on the gate. Just in case.
Very importantly, you can drop that gate on that point where the squares all meet. And that's where you can summon all four more orders in the cardinal directions.
Yep.
why would you put it on the point in the middle if you could just put it at the very edge of one of the zones and still do that?
What I'm saying is not the middle of the square, where the squares intersect. It's really hard because this is an audio medium. But
I understood that, but because you only contest if you're fully in the zone, it's better to leave the gate fully in a square where it can still help contest and still drop guys into three or four other zones.
I see. This is a great thing of just do you want to go for the ultimate maximum value gate that's able to spawn four contesting?
Yeah, I don't understand why you would ever put one on the line when you could still do what you want by keeping it fully within contesting and score.
it depends on what turn of the game, right? Like, if it's right at the end of the game and it's going to and you want to keep it there, that's fine. If it's later, you can't just keep gates on the table. That's too much arc, like, stuck.
Well, that does make sense. But again, we're talking about if you want to get full maximum value for scoring and contesting.
People are also going to forget about manlets. Like, you can drop a manlet somewhere on the table, and they'll think that they've locked down the scenario because they didn't remember your stupid little shield.
This little terrain piece that somehow matters.
Yeah, like, which is the mantlet that self-heals? I think it's, like,
ISA.
The ISA one, yeah. That's going to be irritating. I would just say that, just keep this in mind. This is basically the equivalent of the rule book of this scenario that's, like, you read. It's, like, the first one that says the, like, murder your opponent scenario. That's all it says. Your goal in life is to just murder your opponent. What are the scenario rules? Not much, really. There are four squares. Get in the middle and then murder your opponent. for Warcaster, the game, like, this is what we get, and we get an interesting conundrum that's got some weirdness just because of the fact that second player does second player things.
I feel like this one's way more flexible compared to some of the others because you have such a large place to play the scenario game where most of them are limited to objectives and flags. Which makes it much more rigid. Where this one feels a lot more free flowing, which I find when I played it, this was my favorite one to play so far.
Me too, actually. This is
we both play Marchers, so
Bring up. I mean, even if you're playing like Empyreans, I think Empyreans would love this kind of scenario for just like
they have the ability to put gates out and then fully fuel them with a card. So they don't mind.
I think this scenario actually it has one of the of like a recurring weakness that'll appear in the scenarios. This one takes the second player advantage and turns it up to 11.
Yeah.
But so its worst parts is really bad, but its best parts is actually really good as well. It still produces a very fun game.
Yeah.
So like that's it is an interesting scenario. I really enjoy playing it, and it gives you a lot of freedom on what to do. And it's not just a punch up. There is still quite a lot of like interesting strategy to be put into it. But the second player has so much of an advantage. It's really hard to get across.
Agreed.
All right.
And again, it still has some fulcrum points. Like, as you said, the corners are definitely one. Also, like your table edge, my table edge kind of is still a thing. But I have seen this scenario often. I have seen a couple of times with this game where basically the players do ring around the rosy. So I go, it's not like I've got my back table edge and you've got your front table edge. It's more like I've got the side and you've got the other side. Like, you go right, I go left. Alright, so I like how we just spent a lot of time talking about the scenario that's basically the equivalent of a punch-up in the middle. So let's talk about another one of my... This is probably, like... I did just say that the previous scenario, Absolute Pressure, is my favorite, but this of the, like, objective scenarios, it's my favorite, so this would be the second favorite, and that's Decay Constant.
Constant's really interesting. Six zones, six flags, three of them on your side, one of them closer to the middle, which means that in general, like, there's sort of like a set side, which is, it's really hard to get your opponent's flanks, because not only is that the points on the corners, like, on their side of the table, but it's like really far back. It's 10 inches off their table edge, which means that you have to get like 38 inches up to get to it. But the big thing about this one is that squads score at the end of their activation, not at the end of the pulse round. It's not at the end of the pulse round, which is different than all of the other scenarios. And that changes the way things work, because every single time you're going to activate something, you should be always saying, like, should this activation not be a squad instead?
Yes. We did say this is a game about basically how much is your activation worth? This one, also, one of the things is it has the least amount of the, like, second player goes second player advantage, because...
There is none. If there is no second player
advantage. There is actually a second player advantage. It's just in a very different thing. It's basically just, like, you know how much you need to... It's the classic second player advantage of you know how many points your opponent is going to possibly have going into the end. So you know you need to do. How YOLO, you know, what is the thing you need to do to win the game kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. So it's an informational advantage, but it's not like a... It's not as much of a material advantage as the other scenarios.
It's definitely not like, say, absolute pressure, where the advantage is basically being able to, like, easily deny 3 to 4 points.
But yeah, Decay Constant, it's all squads all the time. This scenario, me talking to Faye a while ago, it sounded like some of the scenarios, missions. Some of the missions are going to be designed with certain unit types in mind. So this is the squad one. Cancel out, it's not Decay Constant. This is Stalingrad. mission is Stalingrad. Put away your fancy toys. You are just throwing wave after wave of your own men at your opponent's killbots and hoping they reach their inbuilt kill limit.
If anyone has played Company of Heroes, basically this is just, you know, any scenario in Company of Heroes, right? You're basically having dudes stand on the things trying to get, like, you know, turn the star from red to blue while you're getting owned by artillery and tanks are showing up randomly and things are just blowing up, right?
Yes, the regular Company of Heroes, the realistic war scenario where everyone's staying at attention while the war happens around them.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, you know, just like another historical gaming sim, Dawn of War, Warhammer 40K.
So this one, it's really hard for you to summon anything but a squad, because think about it like this. You've got these two zones in your back line, which it's really hard for your opponent to ever threaten. And let's say your opponent never threatens them. You still need to activate the squads that are on those points, because you will not get any points if you don't activate them, which means that sometimes you'll be mad at yourself that you have to do it, but you will activate the stupid unit of Paladin Defenders that are sitting on your thing in the corner and go, I wiggle from left to right and I do nothing and I score points from it. And that is the most valuable thing that you can do.
I actually think as a result of all of this, it's not squads that are the most valuable thing, although obviously they're extremely valuable. It's actually solos, because you always get a solo activation with your squads. And as you said, a lot of the times your squad activations are going to be very, very, like, straightjacketed. Even if you have a squad with some capacity to be ranged, like, you know, Paladin Annihilators, for instance, or Ranger, like, Ranger fire teams.
Yeah.
They will be, like, basically stuck to certain points of the map. So when you've got solos, and especially if those solos are capable of killing squads in mass, like Paladin Siegebreakers or Artemis Fang, right? Or any AC Weaver, basically ready to shotgun something, those are what tip the balance in this scenario. Also helpful, I think, is not heavies, but lights. Because you can't summon a squad in a heavy, but you can definitely summon a squad, even with an attachment, and a light. And if you've got lights, like, say, a Dusk Wolf with 2 flamethrowers, or especially if you've got the cards to run it properly, like a Firebrand with some capacity to exploit, like, the hit everything in melee, like, card. And you use those, because you want to kill squads in bulk, and you want to kill them as efficiently as possible, because
best thing you can do, the best strategy you can do, is that if you can move a squad onto your opponent's middle bit and then use that squad to kill a squad on one of their corners, that is the most efficient thing. That will win you the game a lot of the time.
Yes.
So those squads with good long-ranged guns, they're the ones you want to be looking at. So your Paladin Annihilators, your heavy weapons teams, the AC don't quite have any. This is probably AC's weakest scenario. They're not as bad, because solos are still strong, you can get a lot of work out of them. This is a rough one for AC, in my opinion.
I actually don't think it is, weirdly. I mean, it's... Okay, I don't think it will be, because between Rakers and Raiders, Raiders being their range 14 shooting squad, you have a lot of, like, you know, you're actually got squads that have some capacity to, like, shoot other squads and not being competent at it. And Rakers means you've got, like, a model that will be able to, like, if nothing else, right, survive getting owned.
While I agree in general, like, when you're talking about squad on squad combat, the S on S on Pornhub, please don't look that up. A infantryman with one shot does not kill another infantryman very reliably. Even like I believe most of the time when it's like a rat 3 power 4, if you are charged, you kill them 66% of the time, which means that it's likely that you're not going to kill one of them, and that's before cover. If your opponent has cover on any of their models, they're unlikely to kill anything. So none of the AC squads make more than one attack each, except for when you include breakers, but even then melee is not the way that you win this scenario very efficiently. It's not terrible. I'm not saying that they can't win it. I just think that, like, Paladin Annihilators, Paladin Enforcers, and Heavy Weapons teams, and all of the Imperium ones that can make multiple attacks, they're the way that you win this sort of scenario. AC, if they want to win this game, they're going to still be summoning squads to do work, and they'll be using Raiders, and Raiders are fine. But their job is they're trying to deny entire sections of the board with their larger guns. So they can be like, well, it's harder for me to contest my opponent's zone in that way, but if I can just kill everything on the right-hand side of the board, that is how I'm going to catch up.
Yeah. All right, I could actually dig all of that, especially, I mean, realistically, it's such a nine-day comparison of, like, Annihilators to Raiders. on the flip side, though, like as I said, like solos, like I haven't seen AC like do so badly in this scenario because of just how strong solos are.
Yeah.
And specifically their solo package.
If you turbo boost a Nemesis 18 inches onto one of the points like that. If you're like, I have to spend three of my five activation pulse round activations getting my three sides of the board, killing the nemesis on the opponent's side of the board, I've only got two more activations to do it. And squads are not good at killing jacks most of the time, especially not a nemesis with any good amount of like even one arc is enough to make it a pain in the ass if it's got cover.
Yep.
So like those are the sort of things AC needs to pull out more of the tricks to equalize the scenario. Luckily they have them.
Yes. And it turns out the sneaky bin dumpster diver guys are pretty good at doing some kind of dodgy shit in order to win. Also keep in mind, this is one of those scenarios where the game ramps up. It is probably worth it not actually bothering going crazy for points on first pulse round, because every objective is only worth 1 point. But like, you know, two and three, especially three, it's like by turn three, you should have all the squads on the board and be expecting to try and get a score every turn.
You should be like dropping five gates and bringing on two squads in the solos most turns.
Yes. Yep.
And it's this not is
like
where
a squad with an attachment of two solos. Like that is
one of the games. This is like one of the scenarios where you basically use the specialist kit to rotate out one of your not a squad choices for a squad.
And you try to bring more competent fight solos.
Yes. Alright. What's the next scenario? Orders of Magnitude. I love this one. This is another
game. I think Orders of Magnitude is the most standard.
Yeah.
I've qualified as the most standard of the ones in the packet so far. So six scenario zones. All going to be worth 1 point each, and one of them on your side and the corresponding one on the opponent's side is going to be worth three each. Squads only score at the end of the pulse round. Very interesting scenario. I really like it. Pretty much all of the generic, but like it is quite generic in what you're doing. You are essentially, you're probably trying to hold onto your three while attacking your opponent's three. The other scenario zones are not as important.
Yeah. It's basically a hot potato. One of the three, or rather I should say two of the six ones, are going to be the hot potato. The other ones, you sort of just have them just in case. This is another one of the like scenarios that sort of exemplifies the full Battle Force concept where things, like, you know, a lot of things just survive just because they're unimportant. They're all going to be... I've played this scenario where I've gotten a squad onto one of the objectives and have never had that squad do anything the entire game. And I was okay with that.
Yeah.
And hell, you were okay with that too when you summoned a squad of paladin, like, defenders on the corresponding opposite side, and you were okay with them just sitting there. They were just, like, basically on the sidelines, like, you know, having a beer.
They were having their union-mandated break.
Yeah. while, like, you know, on the other side, like, there's a fucking Strike Raptor flying around and dueling with Duchess, while there's, like, you know, some guys are just getting barbecued, and, like, a squad of Rangers are bravely trying to, like, infiltrators are bravely trying to kill, like, 2+ squads to just desperately score one of the points, or even just contest it. And, you know, like, the other side's just like, I guess we'll just chuck a gate out. Good luck, boys.
I'm recalling the gate you're talking... I'm recalling the game you're talking about, but every time I try to bring... remember what the Strike Raptor did, I only remember a blankness and pain. I don't actually remember anything. I'm pretty sure it didn't do anything that game, right?
Nothing worth remembering. Nothing out of the ordinary.
I don't know what to think of, but I think I should ask my therapist if I brought up Strike Raptors at any point near that game. We'll see. We'll get to the bottom of this.
So for this one, do you have to activate the guys to get the points?
No, this is end of the pulse round scoring. So this is definitely the sort of one where, again, there's a second player advantage, and not activating squads is better than activating squads if you can get away with it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the one where you bring a lot of the... This is, again, like one of the ones where Warjacks are more important, because you want Warjacks capable of killing multiple squads in mass, or just a lot of dudes, so that your squad, like, you know, basically you're able to optimize activations. And if possible, you want to be able to get shit onto objectives without having to activate it, so you can activate more efficient models. After all,
yes,
if you can activate a Scythe instead of a unit of dickhead raiders in order to get to, like, you know, and still score a point because you use, like, I don't know, like, what was it, displacement index or something, get those guys on, well, that Scythe is going to kill a whole lot more than a unit of raiders.
Yeah, but this is one of the ones I actually quite enjoy, because you put a squad on it, like, say for me, put a squad on it and then make them stealth, and they sit there the whole time.
It's not bad. The scenario zones are far enough away that stealth can become pretty important. But, like, the main thing I've been finding is that, like, I think the most effective way to win this, like, you can either try to go for, like, I'm going to be scoring all three of my zones. Like, my plan is to score all three of the ones on the table and one of my opponent's ones, and I'm just going to be trying to inch ahead and not try to go face. Or you go the complete opposite, where your plan is to hold your three zone and the opponent's three zone and nothing else.
Yeah.
You just go straight across the table. You turn this game into an assassination. You try to kill your opponent. Like, your opponent, the person standing there.
No. You just invade their personal space. One, personal space. Two, personal space. Three, personal space.
Get out of my personal space.
Exactly. Personal space.
Either of them is fine. As an ISA player, I would probably gravitate towards the first one, where I'm just trying to slowly hold on to my bunker, my side of the table. But, like, if you can contest your opponent's three, going second is really, like, very strong in this one. This is definitely one where if you're going first, not only are you trying to capture your zone, but you're actually your three zone, the one closer to you, you're actually trying to put enough models around there that your opponent can't fit troops there. That is your best plan that you have to go for. Because if you and your opponent are just staring at each other and scoring, like, I get my three and my two twos, and your opponent gets the three and two twos, and then the end of pulse round three, your opponent moves one Ranger fire team member to contest your three, you've lost.
Yeah.
So you're looking to try to get significant advantages in this one. And it's a, I'm partial to the go straight across the table strategy, just because I think you have to control less of the board. And you just go straight for the face.
Yeah.
Sounds funner.
I don't know. Like, keep in mind, like, while only squads can score, anything can contest. Yeah. So, I don't know. I find bunkering isn't as bad a strategy as you're thinking it is, but I would be expecting in pretty much, like, if you actually get a three score off, honestly speaking, I find that you're in such a strong advantage to begin with. It doesn't even matter how the three score happens. So, you should also expect to not actually get three? That. No, as in, like, get one of you, the whatever zone is actually worth 3 BP, if you actually get that for whatever reason, I would honestly think you're in a massive advantage to begin with. Because
unless you've given it to your opponent as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that would be.
But if you get that 3-point lead, it's huge.
Yeah.
Yes.
especially when we, like, there are ways to get around it, and we'll go into that when we finish the scenario pack and talk about secondaries, but, like, scoring is scoring. Yes. All right, next up we have Strange Matter.
This is a weird one.
For a War Machine background, it's weird. For a Malifaux background, it's much more common.
It does make a little more sense that way. You got four permanent objectives, two on your side, two on your opponent's side, pretty square. And there's three.
You score portable... them by controlling them.
Yeah, you score the ones in the square. You squads and solos.
The permanent objective.
Yeah, and any unit can carry the portables. Yeah. And you score one, two, and three per like one on two pulse run one, two on pulse run two, three on pulse run three from holding the ruins. And you get two more if a model holding an artifact is securing the ruin.
And the artifacts are the portable ones.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing. So there's like a 10-inch gap between them. So actually getting that model securing is quite hard. It's good for squads. Squads can do it because, you know, you can leapfrog. Like, but then that squad has to grab the scenario zone and then survive.
Is it an action or anything, or do you just have to touch it?
Just got to touch it.
Okay. Some vehicles would be able to do it too. Maybe sure. Some jacks. Maybe.
That doesn't matter because... you're right. All portable... If a model holding an artifact is securing the ruin, but you can't... Can you have the artifact or whatever artifacts on a squad, on a warjack or a vehicle... be right next to a squad that's actually scoring the rune, or does the squad itself have to have the artifact?
No. You just have to have model touch two and then bring two back to one.
A permanent objective is one the players will attempt to take and hold. The mission will indicate what type of units can hold it. A unit secures a permanent objective that they're within 1 inch of the objective and no enemy unit models, blah, 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 blah. A squad secured is it, blah, 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 blah. I believe there's a slight difference between holding and securing, but it could be cleaned up, to be honest. I don't quite know the way that they want to take it this way. I think what it's probably implying is that if you've got a squad or a solo on the ruin and there's a warjack nearby holding the portable, that should score the two extra.
Rightio. Well, that is definitely something that listeners can like tell us about how we got wrong.
Yeah, we haven't played this one very much. It's a very strange one.
I think this is the only one I haven't played.
I get the feeling also when we played it, we must have fucked up because I don't believe when we played it, we thought that we could pick up shit like the portable objectives with, you know, non-warrior models.
Mm. It's a complicated scenario. It is definitely of the more Malifaux scenario, which it's the model types in Warcaster still more resemble War Machine than Malifaux.
Yep.
There's still more going on, so it's hard to get this sort of level of granularity. Not impossible, of course, and just needs practice.
No, this just needs a bit of cleanup, and Malifaux takes, like, this kind of scenario and then takes it to, like, another level. So I think this is a pretty tidy one that works for Warcaster. They just need to clean up the wording a bit on how things are scored.
The big thing is that if you can get an artifact to your side of the table... like, the only way it's moving... like, if you've got an artifact in a place where a model can just walk it up, pick it up, and walk into it, pick it up, and they are now securing that objective, if it's on your side of the table, that's now where it is unless your opponent's moved it or you move it.
Yeah.
So, like, it becomes really... if you can actually manage to get one or two, or even, if you're very lucky, two of those objectives to your side of the table, it's really hard for your opponent to dislodge you.
I know.
Doing an activation like if Duchess, for instance, walks 9 inches onto one, then walks 5 more inches onto a second one, and then you reactivate her and bring her back onto your side of the table with her holding both, that means that you can now like start to not only are you holding onto two of them, it won't get you any extra points if you've only got on a range of one of your things, but it means your opponent can't get it.
Just FYI. I believe you can only hold one portable objective at a time.
Okay. So okay.
Do that. Like I said, it's not like you only have one interceptor.
Yes. But yeah, it's
really admit that. Yeah.
It's a complicated scenario, And I think that and the general key of it would be to try to move those objectives to your side of the table. Not even if you're trying to score with them. You're just trying to deny it from your opponent. Get one of them onto one of your zones and then just get the rest out, the fuck out.
If anyone remembers the bad old days of, like, there was, like, one of the War Machine scenarios where what you used to do is you used to, like, grab... It was one where you had to destroy an objective, like, twice. And there were certain factions with what they did was they teleported their objective to their side of the table so that you'd never be able to touch it. They could still back in the day. You could try a very similar thing here. Either way, though, this is one of those ones where you can... The portable objective stuff, like, if you have anything that's fast, is so good. And I don't mean just fast in the squad sense. Like, this is one where the freaking nemesis with afterburners is just, like, fucking all life.
Yeah,
it's
life.
So, getting your speedy models, getting them up there, getting those things closer to your side of the table, that's what you're looking for. So AC probably very good because you're not looking at squads movement. You want bursts of speed. So scythes, interceptors, the nemesis, those are all really nice. The fact that they're all a little bit sturdier than just a squad guy is pretty useful. Jack's red blade holding onto one of these things is one of the most irritating things in the universe.
God, yeah.
And
especially because she could then actually score it. Like, I can see Jax basically going on, like, turn, like, you basically get a double activation, but, like, Jax with a jetpack will be able to probably end up grabbing one of the zones. On Pulse 2, she goes and grabs one of the objectives, and then just basically you reactivate her, and she just hightails it all the way back.
Especially if you can give her the Marcher card to give her a free 3-inch movement every turn.
Oh, yeah.
Then she is just going to be, like, doing a montage where she's just walking back and forward. grabbing multiple portable objectives and bringing them back every turn. That card is insane on her, and it is really good in this scenario.
Cyclonic Vitalizer.
That's the one. What
it's called. All right. We'll admit this is one of the ones which I suspect will get played less, just because people will be like, this confuses and frightens us.
A little bit. That's part of why we haven't done it. Surface tension is the next one. It looks quite simple. There's the five separate things like the pips on a D6. The ones on the corners provide cover. The one in the middle does not. Important thing is that the ones close to you score you 1 point at the end of the pulse round when a squad scores it. The one in the middle scores 2, and the one on the opposite side scores 3. So this is another one of the ones where you're kind of trying to trade sides.
Usually happens is it, like, splits down the middle vertically rather than horizontally. Yeah.
So you're trying to go on one side, like, you're probably trying to, go all to the opponent's side of the table with your left-hand side, and you're trying to refuse to flank your right-hand side. So you're trying to keep a lot of tough models on the right-hand side to try to slow down your opponent's advance.
You're trying to reach out and hammer the opponent. You're trying
to reach out to the other side, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's usually the biggest one that is contested is the middle one, as it's the most center, but also worth the points to actually contest and try and capture.
So it generally turns into a side-by-side game with you fighting over the middle, which is fine. That's a perfectly fine way to play it. You're just left into a punch, a sort of like the movements that you'll take. One person player will take the left-hand side, the other one will take the right-hand side, and then the player who can fight the best in the middle wins. If you're the player going second, that's probably the strategy you want to adopt because you get the advantage.
I also find this is one of the ones where parking any non-squad unit with long-range guns on your own side of the table, and especially on your own objectives, is always worth it because, frankly, especially like something like a freaking Reflex Cortex Firebrand, right? Like, that'd be utterly perfect. Because what you want to do is, like, you don't necessarily want to actually score your side of the table. Like, you do it if you just, you know, you can, but, like, it might not actually be worth activating to do so. But you 100% have to make sure you don't just let your opponent easily just sneak in, like some dickhead squad of rangers, you know, walks and jumps and then does their thing, and they leapfrog and skip their way into 3 points. Like,
yeah, the annoying weaver the annoying weaver drops a velocity projector on your one model's your one tough model contesting it. Like you've got a vehicle or something on it, it just gets pushed a little bit and then a ranger taps it. Unacceptable. You need tough stuff that won't get easily removed or moved. Stuff like reflex and dogfighter cortexes are excellent for this.
Yes.
Especially
they can like touch the other. They can like basically interact with the rest of the board. Solos like Jax Redblade or something like that. Like Jax is really good for parking on one of these. Like basically, you want her. Like she might just basically spend two turns getting up to your flag and then throwing out void gates for the rest of the game if you even bother activating her. And she might just be worth it doing that.
The most infuriating thing about Jax is that, remember, the side gates give cover, which means that you could be, like, holding onto your side of the gate in melee with her, and if you choose to shoot her, she'll still have cover, and it will be one of the most infuriating things in the universe.
Yeah.
Because if you melee her to ignore the cover, then she just starts hitting you back.
She would have flight, I believe, at that point.
Or yes.
She
only have
Yeah,
she's charged, so she'll probably be charged. Jax is so infuriating. She's so strong.
She's pretty good.
She's actually let's just take a moment to admire a model that like realistically, she's just a model with stats. Like she flies fast, she hits good, and she has good defense. And just how great that is in this game. It's like it's actually ridiculous. Like, she's the best buddy of a Strike Raptor, or a first-turn Strike Raptor, or a Nemesis summon, just because she'll, like, walk up and just, like, when you double-activate her, she gets to places that are good, and she's just like, I'm just gonna sit here, and I'm gonna just live my best life.
Yeah.
Like, 100%.
The easiest times I've ever killed Jax Redblade are still seared into my memory as being extremely infuriating, because she's got just the high enough stats to be a real pain in the dick.
And then you start compounding it, like, if you're fucking playing marches, then Corobus shows up and basically goes like, okay, so how do you like Jax Redblade with, like, an extra Marauder's worth of, like, shield-guarding wounds that, you know, to just take all, intercept all the shots? Or if you're playing,
you know what, Chris? I don't like it. That's what that's how I feel. I'm not a fan.
0 out of 10. Would not repeat.
Would not. God damn it, Corobus. Like, these, Corobus and her are just these...
They fight a lot of crime. Stacked. They fight so much
crime. Yes, you fight a lot of crime. It's the least and most dynamic duo.
Yep.
It's Batman and Robin, and Robin is just the name of a shield he brought.
Yep.
So this is it's another one of the more standard of the scenarios, but yeah, going across the table and just like, being as aggressive as you can on your opponent's side of the table while just leaving just enough to fight that rear guard to make sure your opponent just doesn't take your side easy, that's the name of the game. And the middle is important for breaking stalemates, but it's not worth fighting over unless there is a stalemate to have.
Yeah, you have to use the middle to leapfrog to someplace worth a damn, kind of is usually how I play it.
Mm.
Now, the final scenario is one we, by and large, do not like.
Oh my god, uncertain principle. Brian and I played it once, and we
had never again.
Like, we pretty much played. We got the most perfect. Like, we didn't. Neither player got screwed, but the capacity for either of us to be screwed so hard
it was super nerve wracking and not in a good way. You just didn't know which turn you were just going to get completely fucked. Neither of us really did, but the game was decided by random dice.
Like, the problem is that already the games have there's a large bias to the player who wins on second. So that's one dice roll, which is already pretty, like, it can shift the game by about 10-15%, like, the odds of winning quite comfortably on its own, right?
Mm.
Which is something that needs to be solved in the future. We can get away with it for a bit, but it needs to be solved. The fact that uncertainty principle also, like, so we'll just explain it really quickly. It's a little bit like the Arc Geyser one. There's six scenarios on it. There's two on your side of the table, two on your opponent's side of the table, quite far up, and there's two right smack bang in the middle. And at the end of the first pulse round, you roll a d6 twice, and two of them get removed from the table, which is just baffling. Because if you're like, if you just suddenly lose the two on your side of the table, your chances of winning just suddenly plummet. The obvious comparisons to orders of magnitude, right? And orders of magnitude is great because nothing gets removed, only added. You might suddenly find that you're in a worse position, but you're not in a position where you have squads which were scoring, which are no longer able to score things. This is a really nasty scenario, and I don't like it. It's the same as the other ones. Squads only score, I think. Yeah, squads can hold matrix nodes, and you score one at the end of turn one, two at the end of turn two, and three at the end of turn three. It's too
like
much.
The worst parts of Incursion from old War Machine across the entire thing. The problem realistically is this, and this scenario can actually be remedied, I think, rather easily. It's basically that you mirror the notes, you do a very similar thing. What happens in the other scenario that we actually do quite like, Orders of Magnitude, where the nodes are mirrored. So you roll a d3 instead of a d6, and for instance, like, you know, the two corner nodes are like, the opposite corners are 1 and 1, the other corners 2 and 2, and the middle nodes 3 and 3, right? Those are the ones, they get removed as pairs. Right? You still have the same effect. It could still screw you, and if you want to keep the scenario in, you're going to have to be ready for this kind of thing, but that way at least this effect is going to be balanced as opposed to what will happen very much like, I roll a 1 and I roll a 2, and that means the player who starts on one side of the table gets nothing.
Yeah, and like, there's so many versions, like, there's so many sets of 2, then 4 die, which just rely on just, like, I'm pretty sure there's less game states which end up balanced than there are ones that are unbalanced, right? Like, 5 and 6 disappearing, so the two middle ones disappearing. Like, that means that the scenario zones are now, like, 38 inches apart or something. 28 inches apart from each other, which is insane. It is a weird-ass game. That was pretty much what happened with me and Brian, where, like, the middle ones disappeared and I was in a very, very strong position, and the only, like, if one of Brian's ones, like, if the dice rolled one, Brian was just going to go, no, I quit, I'm out, because the one place that was giving him hope, the ability to actually win, just disappeared in front of him. It's random in a bad way. There's fine having random losses to change the way that the scenarios work in the mid-game. This is not a good version of that.
Yeah. Actually, I think you're onto something. It's like, the problem is the corner ones are too much in the corner. Like, the corner ones were closer, right? So let's just say that, like, I don't know, 1 and 3 disappear, right? At least the troops that you've got deployed around those nodes are still able to go and, like, interact with the other nodes, right? Like, you could have a squad that was capping 3 actually realistically be able to reach the center of the board. Whereas there, like, how far away is that? That's, oh god, 20 by 24? So you're looking at, oh god, like 14 to 15 inches between number 3 and, like, you know, the corner nodes and one of the center ones. And that's assuming the one closer to your guys is still around. It could also disappear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
not
good.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining playing this in, like, a tournament setting where you've got, like, a tables of 12 and then one or two on your side disappears. Oh, well, got to walk over to the other side of the table now. Let me just pass through everyone to walk on the other side because that's where the game's now played.
Yeah, like, if you're the ones on your side of the table, like, if you aren't playing on a 4x4, like, on a 4x4 table with space beside it, but you're actually playing on how tournaments work, where there's, like, table next to table next to table next to table, all of a sudden, like, this entire half of the board doesn't matter anymore. And
my back only hurts from thinking about it.
Yeah. Not a fan at all. It's remediable, but I think the underlying assumption with this sort of scenario is not something that should be repeated.
Yes. I think it's not unsalvageable. And here's the thing to me, is like, Pendulum is to me a bit of a work in progress.
Of course.
I think it's a good work in progress. Like, again, like, I think actually you change how the gates disappear and you also move the corner points close to the center and you get, like, the same kind of effect. Because I kind of like Incursion's, like, disappearing flag mechanic when it wasn't really abused, just as a general idea of, like, keeping the battlefield dynamic. But I think you're, like, Orders of Magnitude pulls off that effect better without necessarily just utterly screwing you. It's like, there's a very big difference between, like, what happens in Orders of Magnitude, where your squad goes from being the focus of the table to being apathetic bystanders. but they're still contributing and they're still like basically part of the game. Whereas in here, let's just say you have a squad that's camping your corner and then the corner just goes away. Well, that squad is now actually in the middle of nowhere.
So I've had I've done a little bit of game design at home for some things, and my philosophy on this sort of thing, which I've read about before as well, it's not just me. When you're talking about making a game fun, the thing that you really should be looking at is not accentuating the feels goods, but removing as many of the feels bads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Orders of Magnitude does that by essentially going like, nothing's getting removed. The table state is there. Certain parts are becoming more important than others, but your squad who is camping on a 3 point might suddenly be camping on a 1 point.
Yeah. So like the maximum value goes up, but the minimum value never goes down.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
This one, the maximum never goes up and the minimum only ever goes down.
Actually, yeah. That's incorrect. The maximum does go up, but it goes up in an unfair way. Like, there is a very easy way the maximum goes up for you. It's that your opponent gets dicked, right?
Oh, like, I was talking per point rather than the
table. Per point, right. Yeah,
fair enough. Per point, the point never gains any value. It only ever loses it. But yes, yeah. if you're talking table-wide, you can gain just by opponent. And, like, if you're talking about the game as a social contract, a social interaction, right? What do you say to the opponent who just rolled the two dice and got screwed? Sorry.
You say, sorry, I'm so good at Warcast. And then your opponent goes like, please tell me what podcast you listen to for all of these great gaming ideas. And they'll say like, I listened to a cast that wasn't called Encrypted Command. I listened to a good podcast.
I listened to Charge and Spike. So bad scenario, very bad. Please come see me after class. Do not do this. I really don't like the underlying assumptions of it. Brian and I played it once, and it just was not a thing that we would ever want to repeat. Even in its best case scenario, it just wasn't very good. No. It's not forcing tactical decisions, except for like the why you put him there. So. It's not fun and it's not tactical, so it probably shouldn't be in your organized play pack for fun and tactics.
Yeah, but again, like, this is to me like an evolving, like, it's an evolving part of Warcaster, is how these scenarios will change and adapt. And
yeah, I am harsh because I love.
See more of the Strange Matters, just because it's different, especially when you compare it to games like War Machine. So I'd like to see them put some more effort into trying to create those kind of dynamic, moving... objectives. Sorry? Yeah.
The one thing I do like, the portable objectives do benefit the first player more than the second.
Ooh, yes.
Because it's whoever gets there first.
So that is, like, if you're trying to find a way to reduce the second player advantage, portable objectives are a way that you can look into doing that.
Yeah.
Yep. I would like there to be specific rules for being able to drop portable objectives beyond dying recalling.
Like I said, with like Malifaux's game designed with this kind of play in mind, so they have things like interact actions, which are specifically designed to do that kind of thing. Where Warcaster doesn't seem to have anything built in.
If you look at the if you look at the narrative league that they released, some of the scenarios there had that one of them, like the scenario zones were little pieces of machinery, and a blanket rule was that every warrior model gained the Tinker special action.
Okay, and maybe that's something they should just add.
Yeah, and so what would happen is that when a warrior model, so during that scenario, the way you got scenario points is that when you tinkered a thing, you'd get a random effect, but you'd also gain a token, and the token would give you the points at the end of the turn.
Sure.
Which is a way to mimic that sort of thing, the mimic and interact action. I don't want to be a Debbie Downer though, because we are harsh because we love. It's a shame that Uncertainty Principle is the last one. We probably should have gotten in the reverse order. That is the only one which I really just I do not see the point of the design. The rest of them I see the reason that they're doing it, even if I'm not necessarily fully happy with the results.
Yeah, well, that's quite okay. Like, I think this... I mean, look, Warcaster is a game basically about scenario, and it, I think actually one of the things with Warcaster to me is that a lot of the scenario assumptions come from War Machine. Like the fact that usually you need to throw second player a bone because, you know, second player gets like less chance to kill models effectively, right? Well, in this game about where killing models has less actual absolute value than it does in War Machine,
because your Alpha Strike is only ever one unit and one solo.
Yes.
You can't. Yeah. You don't have the Kara Sloan effect where, like, you just maximize. If you maximize what you're good at, you will get better results.
Yes. So as a result of all of that, like, I could see things changing. Like, how actually, I could see, for instance, like contesting objectives being changed to basically be similar to how Marvel Crisis Protocol does it, in that you actually have to have more individual units around a thing. So, for instance, if you have two units around some piece, I've got one, you still control that. You don't just, like, not cease controlling it just because some ranger scores a touchdown and, like, invades your personal space.
It also means like, that, like, you can have things like vehicles and jacks score things, but squads are more valuable because as soon as a squad shows up, they essentially take over that flag or objective or space.
Because like, so like, you do it by a per model basis, for instance.
Yes, you could do like, it per model. You could also flip it as well if you wanted to and just make it by a deployment cost. That would still be pretty good for squads because they've got a blade of wounds while still being deployment cost too. But yeah, that is a method you can do it. I've been tinkering around with an idea of just eliminating the concept of contesting altogether.
It would be interesting.
So it doesn't affect if contest, but if there is a squad and if two people are holding onto the same flag, then they both score it, which is functionally the same, but it does some alterations to timing. I do quite like the idea of more models. Yeah, it also does feel better, but like I do like the idea of more models. Like the person with the most models on a point is the one who secures it.
Yes.
Yeah. There are some nuances you could do to that as well, because you could still say like this scenario this thing can only be secured like scored by squads, and so if I had a squad on a if I had one squad member on a zone and you had two jacks on a zone, yeah, the jacks are securing it but they get 0 points.
Yes.
While the squads
there's ways you can do it. Like I think that's the thing though, is like, for an initial hit out in a game that was released in a time where people literally cannot physically play it unless they happen to be in a country that, you know, doesn't have a rampant coronavirus problem, this is still a good scenario pack.
Yeah, it is a perfectly fine accessible scenario pack, and that is about the best. And
especially for an initial. Yeah, correct. And that's fine. Speaking of which, I want to get into something which I think is actually, like, it's a part of the game which I feel is going to probably be maybe as big a part, if not a bigger part, even more important to the way the game works, and that is secondary missions. Because to me, secondary missions remind me a lot of secondary objectives in Twilight Imperium, a game we all quite love when we can ever finish it. And
it takes 2 hours. You're fine.
It can take 2 hours. Well, that's the thing, is like everyone goes on like TI can go for like 12 hours or so. And like, I actually can agree, like the full game, I do not like a full game of TI, like a full proper game. But a fast game, which is like 10 victory points instead of the 13 or 14 it's meant to be. One of the reasons I like the small game much better is because you basically, all players have up to three cards, which are private secondary missions. And they can fulfill these doing a bunch of random shit, like, you know, blowing something up with your flagship or destroying something using space cannons or whatever. Like, they're all kind of weird and they encourage you to do different things, but they are a secondary independent source of scoring to the main scoring, which in Twilight Imperium's case is basically randomly cards get dropped off the top of the deck and they tell you, you do random things, you score this, and it's a sequential thing. You can only score one public objective every turn. Very similar to how, like, in Warcaster, all of these scenarios, you have, like, how the scoring is meant to be. You score at the end of the turn. It's very structured and regimented. The secondary missions basically throw a wrench in the works, and I think this is important because one of the issues I had early in Warcaster, especially when we didn't play with secondaries, is that sometimes you just get the that you get the problem where someone pulls too far ahead and then the other guys decide there's no point in continuing, right? I'm just going to concede. There's no, it's not like War Machine where there's the safety valve of assassination, and other games have similar mechanics as well to better or lesser extents. Secondary missions,
it's not,
however,
it's not just the, it's not just assassination. It's also the War Machine. Unless things have changed since I played it, the fact that you can win if you end the turn with X more scenario points than your opponent. That is another way.
Well,
that, like,
yeah, that's actually
early game end. I find it important because, like, concession is a thing that always exists in games, but I don't like the thought of, like, the only way to end the game early is by conceding, because it means that, like, pride and emotions start to become more of a thing, which I don't like. It's another reducing the feels bad. If there's a rule which says, oh, you got this, you beat me, then you're not conceding. It's not about pride. It's not anything like that. People can't get mad if they win by the rules, essentially. I quite like that. And I would not be opposed to instituting something like that to Warcaster eventually, once they get their handle on the way that they want things to win.
Either way, though, I'm like, I like the concept of secondary missions. It's a pity there's only one secondary mission.
it's like, these are not balanced. These are bad.
Okay,
these are 100% bad.
I'm just going to tell you, there are actually two secondary missions. There is missions that aren't body count, and then there is body count.
Yes.
And body count, I think, is, here's the thing. Like, if we're going by Arian's game design, my thoughts are actually that body count is the proper secondary mission. Like, it's actually the one you want, right? All of the other ones should be adjusted to be in line with body count. And body count, for what it's worth, is
that's fine.
The first time you destroy three or more of your opponent's units during a single turn, gain two victory points.
It's not the first time, it's each time.
Each time, yes. Right? And that's the thing. It's like, it's not the first time, like Recon, which was what I was actually reading and then dyslexically getting
Recon
confused.
Is so bad in comparison.
Yeah. It's, you get 3 points for basically
so bad.
Scoring a touchdown.
And Recon is the only one that's close to power in body count.
Yeah. There's like
but
one
it's
for
limited to once in the game.
Yes, yeah. And it's the only one that is close to body count in effect.
So you get 3 points. You get 3 points once in the game if you get one of your models to your opponent's deployment zone. Body count, you score 2 points for killing three or more of your opponent's units during a single turn, but that's for like every turn.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree. And then its body count is that one. Then there's recon, which I think is like, you know, it's like 20% of body count's power, and then the rest are like 1%.
Huh.
Yeah.
The only way I can see recon working is in the smaller game, skirmish.
No, recon works fine. It's just it doesn't scale in the same way body count does.
Yes.
So, all right, I'm
going
to.
I actually think Cameron is kind of right. You can.
It's easier in skirmish.
Yeah, it's much better than skirmish. But
it's
I guess
much better
than
skirmish.
Yeah.
But you know what's really good in skirmish, where everything dies? Body count. I actually don't agree with the original thing. I don't think body count should exist. I think the secondaries should never be about killing directly. I really think that the way to make secondaries successful is by giving you the ability to tinker to your list a effect on the table which you wouldn't otherwise do necessarily. So, like, I don't really like any of these, to be honest. By that criteria, the only one I quite like that comes close is Salvage, and even then it's not great, or Overrun. The things like if you, like, gain a point if you slam a model into a terrain feature, right?
You want to do, that, like, not Brawl Machine, but Summer Rampage-type rules?
Yeah.
Where you, by doing cool things,
yeah,
you get points.
That's actually fair. Or in that case, right, I could see, like, you have body count just exist and be the lowest common thing. Like, it'd be 1 point for killing three things. And all of the other ones about doing cool but not necessarily, like, optimal things to get you more points. Either way, though, like, secondaries, I think,
keep
as a concept of...
Yeah, keep them. They're a great idea.
No, they are. They're more importantly... Yeah.
It's what made Malifaux work, in my opinion, right? Malifaux's schemes make the game so much more interesting because you've got players who can tool their lists to the schemes that they want. And like and in Malifaux, it's secret. It doesn't need to be secret in Warcaster. But like the fact is that it's a way of getting points which you're not necessarily directly engaging with your opponent, right? All of the scenarios are head-to-head. It's the point is for you or for them. But secondaries give you the opportunity to be a little more loosey-goosey with it, give you things that you can do which your opponent can't quite predict. So you could try to move like water away from the main scenario zones. And if, like the one that I had as the example of, like if you, whenever you slam a model into a terrain feature or another model, depends on the way you want to work it, you gain a point. You can build a list around that. You can build a strategy around it, and your opponent doesn't necessarily need to see it coming until it fully happens, and they can still position away from it. They can make it harder for you. That's what a good secondary would be, in my opinion. Things like every time you end an activation, every time one of your models ends its activation, is the thing that's highest up on the table, like the highest elevation, like King of the Hill, right? It's a thing that your opponent can mess with. It's a thing that they can deal with. It's not something that you can easily chain because it'll be the same activations over and over again. And it's not necessarily something you want to do as part of the game. The problem with body count is that body count gives you a huge benefit for doing something that's already good.
I like murder, 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 murder.
Yeah. If at the end of the turn, if you're like, I killed three units in that turn, that's the benefit. The benefit is that your opponent is three units down. Being on the table and your opponent's like, oh, you just killed three of my units and you got ahead in scenario for doing it, and now I can't fight back, meaning that my ability to kill three units is curtailed, as is my ability to get scenario is curtailed.
I will say killing three units a turn is not like the easiest task to perform. It's just the opportunity is way higher than any of the others in terms of like being able to score them.
Yeah, on average, I've seen body count proc twice per player per game, roughly as an average.
It usually takes two turns to set up, is my experience. Like, a lot of times you actually, if you're playing for body count, you usually are, like, killing squads down to, like, one or two members, and then prepping to activate, like, something which can make multiple attacks, like a unit of Annihilators plus a Siege Breaker, or a Strike Raptor plus, like, you know, fucking Artemis Fang or some other solo. It'd be that kind of thing. Or a Scythe, and doesn't matter because you just activated a Scythe.
It's not the easiest to perform, but it's the most, like, abusable.
Well, I mean, it repeatedly triggers. I don't know. Like, I like this kind of safety valve here, and I think you kind of do need something like this just to stop scenario blowouts from happening. And again, like, I don't know how much what the I think there's going to be a lot of tinkering with the balance between secondaries versus primaries. But I feel like in order to make sure this game doesn't go into a you win, you're up 1 point at the end of Pulse Round 2, there's no point in continuing because you're also second player, right? Like, that is not a good game for anyone, right?
Yeah.
And it's definitely not going to have, like, the feels good. You're not going to walk away from going, like, yeah, that was a great game of Warcast. I conceded end of Pulse Round 2, and I felt great about it.
Oh, by the way, this is us going just talking about what we want from secondary missions. If you're just here for this raw tactics, your tactic is pick body count.
I just told you, there is only one secondary mission at present. It's body count.
Play your models which are good at causing body count, things like firebrands, things like strike raptors. Be a real bitch to your opponent, and like body count's really nasty because if your opponent summons a your opponents will often summon three units off a gate, and it's the worst, feels bad if you put a gate in the bad place, summon three units, and then you immediately lose them before you get to activate them, and your opponent has also gained scenario points off it. Yikes.
Yeah, that's pretty gross.
Yeah. I find if body count exists, like, and it looks like your opponent's going to start triggering it, what actually happens is, like, basically you start summoning, like, a warjack and a squad instead of solos. But then that leads to other problems when you're just like, oh, shit, I'm out of solo activate. Solos become very scary to deploy, especially if you're playing, say, marches where your solos are fragile. Like, I mean, AC can sort of get away with not caring because, like, if they just, you know, have four marauders and the curator clown car out of a gate, right? They're probably okay with that setup, right? Like, you know, the chance of you actually triggering body count off of that thing is very possible, but quite difficult. Again, like, body count does usually require some setup, and it's a dice thing. It can get screwed up. I also do... is things I can't help but love body count just for, like, the freaking really weird YOLO all-ins you sort of go to get that last kill, and the way it does actually force you to perform differently. I just wish it wasn't the only secondary worth picking, right?
Yep.
I would tend to agree, like, basically, it's upside, it does reward you a bit too much for doing something you're already good at, but at the same time, I think that just means that all the ones that should reward you for doing something you're not necessarily interested in should just be brought in line. All right, look, we've been talking for a while, and it's funny, I didn't think this cast was going to last this long, but scenarios being what they are, it's a complicated matter, and it's
maybe as Warcaster, we can last all night long.
I mean,
it's a complicated topic, and we're approaching it from two different angles of, like, how can this be improved, but also what is the way to win right now. And, like, I hope we've given some insights into the interesting parts of, like, the games are still interesting. The tactics are the tactics you still have to think on the fly, but you have to keep your eye on the prize. Having a plan is better. Even having a bad plan is better than not having a plan at all. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing in the future what Primetip Press comes up with for new scenarios and the next iteration of Pendulum. I really like the idea of secondaries. I really like the direction a lot of their scenarios are going, and I really like the escalation format. I think the escalation format is a stroke of genius, which really helps a lot of other things, really helps legitimize a lot of other parts of the game, which otherwise might have stagnated.
Correct. Is there anything else we should discuss? I think we're good to go. Good.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for another episode of Encrypted Command, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.